The Juneau World Affairs Council, in cooperation with 360 North, presents Will People in Alaska and the South Pacific Be Forced to Relocate? The Human Rights Implications of Climate Change and Population Displacement with Robin Bronin. Bronin is a senior research scientist at the Institute of Arctic Biology at the University of Alaska Fairbanks and a human rights attorney.
Thank you, everybody, for being here this afternoon. I am just really honored to be here, and I really want to thank the Juneau World Affairs Council because this is really my first opportunity to present my research in Alaska. I've, as Joanne mentioned, I've been traveling around the world as people have been really interested to know about what's happening here in the Arctic. So thank you so much for being here today, and I hope you have lots of questions at the end. So I'm going to start my presentation by talking about what's happening in regard to climate change. I'm a social scientist, not a climate scientist in regard to the physics of it, but because of the research that I'm doing in regard to the population displacement, I've incorporated how climate change is impacting population movements. And I started my research, Joanne mentioned that I work as a human rights attorney. I've actually worked as an immigration attorney here in Alaska since the mid-90s, and I've lived in Alaska since the late 80s, and started noticing that there were significant changes happening in our state. I'm outdoors a lot, and so in 2007, I went back to graduate school. I decided to enroll in the Resilience and Adaptation Program at the University of Alaska at Fairbanks. And coincidentally, at the same time, I started hearing about the villages that were needing to relocate in Western Alaska. And so, and because I worked as an immigration attorney, I also was really intrigued by this popularized term, climate refugee. I've worked with political refugees from all over the world, and so my research initially was really looking about whether or not there was any similarity between political refugees and climate refugees. So if you've been paying attention to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and the reports that they have been issuing, this year they just issued their fifth assessment report, and just 4 days ago, they issued the synthesis. There were three reports that have been issued, I believe, over the course of maybe the last year. One talking about the physical science, the second one talking about adaptation, and I believe the third one was about mitigation. And this report, which was just issued, is for policymakers, and I'm really passionate about this issue because we should be really, really concerned about what is happening in regard to climate change on our planet. So the top graph is about what is happening in regard to sea level rise. And as you can see with each of these graphs, the trajectory is up. So with sea level rise, there's huge uncertainty in regard to how much sea level is going to rise by when, which has huge implications for coastal communities all over the world. And with this most recent report, what they're saying now is anywhere between 1 to 6 feet by the end of the century, with variations depending on whether land is subsiding in addition to sea level rise. And then in regard to the second graph, the greenhouse gas concentrations, so the concern is scientists have figured out how much carbon we can actually put into our atmosphere by what time in order not to go beyond 2 degrees Celsius. So that's what the negotiators at the with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the UN framework on climate change, they have been trying to keep us at 2 degrees Celsius or below. And in order for us to be able to maintain 2 degrees Celsius or below, we only have about a third more carbon that we can emit. So based on the research that's been done, physical scientists have determined that we can only emit 2,900 gigatons of carbon into the atmosphere without going beyond that 2 degrees Celsius increase in temperatures, and we have already emitted 1,900 gigatons, And so these scientists have predicted that we only have 17 years before we get to that 2900 gigaton amount. And then beyond that, of course, climate, the temperatures will continue to rise. And they're thinking, because we're not reducing our carbon emissions, that we could, and this is globally, this is not about the Arctic or Alaska, that globally, by the end of the century, we could be looking at a 4 degrees Celsius or warmer temperature increase. So in doing my research, it became clear to me that the term climate refugees was really an inappropriate term to use to talk about the type of displacement that we are going to be looking at and that is currently happening because of climate change. And so I created a word called climate migration, because I wanted to be really clear about what I was researching here in Alaska, which was the community displacement of people. So it wasn't just individuals being displaced or households, it was an entire community being displaced only because of environmental changes. And so the significant thing about climate change that is different from, for instance, other migration patterns, whether it's internationally or internal migration within a country, is that land is going to permanently disappear. We know that. And it's primarily going to happen along the coasts. We don't know how quickly, as I was mentioning, and it's primarily going to be because of sea level rise and erosion. So it's this permanent disappearance of land that is going to cause the permanent displacement of people that creates, at least from what I've been researching so far, an unprecedented humanitarian crisis. And I will explain why it's an unprecedented humanitarian crisis in a little bit. So going back to climate change and what's happening in Alaska, we have already, so I mentioned, you know, globally, the negotiators at the UN Framework on Climate Change Convention are trying to keep us globally below 2 degrees Celsius. Well, we have already in Alaska in the wintertime experienced a 3.5 degrees Celsius increase, and that's the statewide average. That's not talking about any particular community. And modelers, and this was kind of honestly shocking to me when I read this earlier, modelers at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks are predicting that our state average possibly by the end of the century is 8 to 9 degrees Celsius increase from where we are now, which is just, I can't even imagine what an Alaska will look like with an 8 to 9 degrees Celsius increase by the end of the century. And so the thing that's significant about the temperature increase and in regard to this issue of population displacement, particularly in western Alaska, is we're seeing decreased Arctic sea ice, we're seeing thawing permafrost, and repeated extreme weather events. And it's that combination of all of those things that are causing accelerated rates of erosion and making communities in western Alaska think that relocation is their only option. So when I speak around the world, I always talk about Arctic sea ice. And for any person who is skeptical about whether climate change is happening, I talk about Arctic sea ice, because it really is the harbinger of what is radically happening on our planet. So this is from 2012. That lavender line is what the median extent of sea ice has historically been. And in 2012, you can see the decrease. And the thing that was significant about 2012 was that this historic decrease in Arctic sea ice, normally the minimum extent is measured in the middle of September, and this decrease was measured at the end of August, so 3 weeks earlier than normal. I just read a paper, so people now are trying to figure out how quickly there's going to be no more Arctic sea ice, right? I mean, which is just, again, unimaginable. And so a mathematician said that he predicts, and this was a paper that was just released within the last week, that there could be no Arctic sea ice in the summertime by 2020. I was at a conference in January where an Inupiat whaler said he thought there would be no Arctic sea ice in the summertime within the next 10 years. The mathematician was clear that it doesn't mean that it's going to be like the Pacific Ocean, where there's no ice, but we won't have solid Arctic sea ice as it is now. And the volume decrease in Arctic sea ice is what's really troubling and causing people to think that it's going to be in the not too distant future where there will be no Arctic sea ice during the summertime. So often when I travel around to just have people, you know, understand the radical changes. So this was the photograph on the right was in the Alaska Dispatch News, and this was from this past August, where it was in the mid-70s, in the middle of August, and you have children jumping into the subarctic ocean. And this was, of course, above the Arctic Circle. And this image is from a storm that is heading our way as we speak. This is Super Typhoon Nori, and it is now off the east coast, I believe, of Japan, heading up towards the Bering Sea. So this was the fifth super typhoon of this year. Super typhoons are typhoons that have a wind speed, sustained wind speed, of more than 150 miles per hour. And this super typhoon, what was noted is that those sustained winds stayed at more than 150 miles per hour for more than 24 hours, which was extremely rare. This super typhoon has decreased in intensity, but the concern is that it is heading, when it gets into the Bering Sea, it's going to intensify. And I don't understand the science enough to know why it's going to intensify. But as I talk about these Western Alaskan communities, I am really concerned about their safety, and I hope you keep them in your thoughts for this weekend, because it's going to be on Friday night and over the weekend that this super typhoon gets into the Bering Sea. So to talk now about population displacement, I've sort of mentioned the different ways that people are displaced. And so in thinking about climate change and the way people are going to be displaced, so there are very few group of researchers really looking at this issue, and honestly, not many of them actually have the experience of working with communities who are experiencing climate change and actually making the decision to relocate. And so the different ways that climate change may impact population mobility will depend on what that climate change manifestation is at the local level. So when I think of drought, and if drought is the only climate change impact, that's probably going to impact people on an individual or household level. It's not necessarily going to be a community-wide event, because when drought happens, the resources, so for instance, the financial resources available to an individual or household, will determine whether somebody may want to move when a drought is happening, like right now in California. And then you have the displacement caused by extreme weather events, like Hurricane Sandy, where you get this massive displacement of people for a temporary period of time. And so it's the combination of both of those things that, in my research in Alaska, so it's the combination of these, what we in the research world called slow onset, like drought, but in Western Alaska, it's erosion. So it's something that's ongoing, that is happening not based on anything other than, you know, extreme weather events and thawing permafrost and decreased Arctic sea ice. So it's that combination. So the erosion is already happening. And then you have repeated extreme weather events, like what's about to happen again in Western Alaska. So in Western Alaska, between like 1989 and 2006, there were six extreme weather events that happened that really accelerated the rates of erosion that made the communities in Western Alaska really start moving towards thinking that relocation was their only adaptation strategy. And one of the things that has made my research easier is that there have been so many government studies, federal, state, talking about what's happening in Alaska, and particularly with Alaska Native communities. So in 2003, the U.S. Government Accountability Office issued a report, and at that time, they found that three communities in Alaska were thinking of relocating, and that there were 184 other communities that were being impacted by erosion and flooding. And then 6 years later, the same office did a report, and they found that 12 communities were seeking to relocate. So in just a very short period of time, the number of communities that were thinking, again, that relocation was their only adaptation strategy to climate change had quadrupled. So these are the communities that have been talking about relocation. And it's still the thing about this issue of relocation that I'm going to again talk about in just a little bit is there's no institutional framework to facilitate relocation. And so while these communities in 2009 were thinking that relocation was going to be their only option, the fact that no community has yet relocated, that only one community has found a relocation site and is actively in a relocation process, and that we don't have an institutional framework to really address this issue, has made it extremely difficult for communities to now say, I want to relocate. Because when they make that decision, they could lose access to government funding for the infrastructure that is in their current community. So if you're in a community like Kivalina and you need maintenance on your water and sewage treatment facility, the government may be less likely to provide you with that funding because you're thinking of relocating, which makes sense from a government viewpoint, looking at efficient funding. But from a community standpoint where you have no knowledge of actually when you're going to relocate, it makes it really, really difficult to live with damaged or destroyed infrastructure. And when you have these huge community needs in regard to, for instance, water and sewage. So the community that I focused on most intensely in my research, and I'm so appreciative of the Nutak Traditional Council, the Nutak Planning Group, and specifically Stanley Tom, who is the tribal liaison, is Nutak, when I started doing my research in 2007, they were the only community that was actively in a process of relocating. And part of the reason was is Nutak identified land that the government said was a good place for them to go to, meaning that it wasn't going to be vulnerable to permafrost thawing. And I should mention that all of the communities, the Alaska Native communities that I've had the honor to work with, have done everything possible to make sure that they're safe, to educate people in our community, government officials. They have gone lobbying to Washington, D.C. to explain their situation, to get the resources that they need to relocate their communities. So they have been extraordinarily proactive, and I have learned so much from them, and yet still they're in this really dire situation. So with Nutak, there was the ongoing environmental changes, which were accelerating rates of erosion. The big piece about this, the impact of climate change and whether or not we can stay in the places where we live, is whether or not technology is going to be able to protect us. That's something that we really don't know. And based on what's happening in Alaska, questionable. We don't really know. And it's not just about Alaska. It's about, I'm originally from New York, and I was in New York when Hurricane Sandy happened. Questionable about whether or not we have the technology to protect Lower Manhattan. And so in Nutak, they tried. They tried to protect the community with erosion control devices. They spent $1.5 million and then determined that it was not cost-effective to continue to try to protect the community with erosion control devices. I use Kivalina as an example of why we really don't know whether technology can protect us. So in 2006, I believe it was, Kivalina had just completed a seawall to protect their community. Big event. Senator Ted Stevens flew in for the celebration that was going to happen along with other federal officials. And the day that he flew in, a huge storm came in and 180 feet of that new seawall was destroyed. And then a year later, two-thirds of the community needed to be evacuated because of a severe storm that came in. So, and they have now, they have rebuilt their seawall, as has Shishmaref, but the lifespan of these seawalls is, you know, depending on who you're talking to, 10 to 15, 20 years, which when you're thinking about your own safety and a storm like the super typhoon we just saw, you want to know that you're safer for longer than 10 to 15 years. And as I mentioned earlier, it's these repeated extreme weather events that really are threatening the lives of folks on Western Alaska. So I mentioned the NUTOC Planning Group, which was an amazing and is an amazing intergovernmental effort. And I learned a lot from watching the NUTOC Planning Group work. So that was an intergovernmental agency or working group that involved 25 different federal, state, and tribal government entities. No one of those agencies had any mandate to help relocate NUTOC. They didn't have any specific funding to facilitate NUTOC's relocation, but they worked really, really hard to make NUTOC's relocation possible. And just as an example of just the, because they had no mandate in regard to their, there was no relocation funding specifically available for their relocation, to give you an idea of what sort of cooperation was required. So as you know, Western Alaska, no roads, and the place where NUTOC is choosing to relocate to is 9 miles south of where their current village is, across the Ninglick River, right? So no infrastructure there. And so one of the first things that needed to be built there was a barge landing so that they could get the other materials to build at their relocation site. And it took 7 different federal and state government agencies, tribal government agencies, to build that barge landing, which was completed, I believe, 3 or 4 years ago. And so every time, because we don't have this relocation institutional framework, it just creates inordinate challenges because there's no one government agency that's responsible for doing any one piece of the relocation effort. And so it's really maxing out state and federal government agencies that are already have limited resources to figure out how it is that they're going to work together to build this infrastructure at relocation sites. And with Kivalina and Shishmaref, the reasons why they have not moved forward with their relocation is because the places where they have chosen, so each of these communities, Shishmaref, Kivalina, and NUTOC, have chosen relocation sites. They've brought they've identified several relocation sites and then had their community members vote to decide to which relocation site they should move to. And Kivalina, I believe, has voted at least 5 or 6 times on where they should relocate to. Shishmaref, I think, at least 3 times. And unfortunately, government, federal and state government officials are saying that the relocation site that they've chosen is prone to permafrost, and so they're not providing the technical assistance to assist the community to relocate at their to their preferred relocation site, which again makes sense from a government perspective. You want to make sure if you're going to build new infrastructure at a relocation site that it's going to be able to be there for the long term. But without providing guidelines to communities beforehand, before they go through this multi-year process of identifying relocation sites and then voting on it, it makes it really, really difficult for communities to sustain the energy and resources it takes to actually relocate their entire community. So the other part of this talk is about the South Pacific. And I had the incredible honor of traveling to the Papua New Guinea with 2 folks from the NUTOC Traditional Council in 2012. And the reason why we went to Papua New Guinea is because at that time in 2012, the Carteret Islands were the only other place in the world where the community had decided that relocation was their only option. And so I'm not sure on this map if you can see where the Carteret Islands are, but it's near, you can see where the Solomon Islands are, and Bougainville Island is where they will relocate to. So three of us traveled to Bougainville Island to their relocation site, and then went to the Carteret Islands, which an aluminum skiff for like 5 hours in the open ocean to get out to where these atolls are. And they are relocating because of sea level rise, king tides. They have these high tide events that are not associated with any extreme weather event that's causing their water source, their fresh water source, to disappear, their gardens to die. And so they are moving to Bougainville. And similar to here, so what was really interesting about going to Papua New Guinea was that they've started their relocation process around the same time that the folks in Alaska had started their relocation process. And they were having the same similar challenges. So in Papua New Guinea, unlike Alaska, the national government was not facilitating. The national government hadn't figured out like how they were going to support this relocation effort. So the Tulele Pesa was the non-governmental organization that the Carteret Islander clan elders created. They were going to other governments, so like Australia, and foundations to fund their relocation effort, and it was being done, their relocation was being done by just this very small group of people. And they are still in a relocation process. There are about 2,700 people that need to relocate to Bougainville Island. And the newest to me place that I've recently learned about at meetings that I was just at earlier this year are Fijian. So again, what I'm really interested in is communities that are making this decision that relocation is the only adaptation strategy that they have. And similar to Alaska and Papua New Guinea, the Carteret Islands, extreme weather events with the ongoing erosion caused by sea level rise, and the Fijian government is actually trying to come up with an institutional framework, because this community, Vunidogoloa, is just one of dozens of communities that are needing to relocate from the various atolls in Fiji. And so I'm hoping to go there in January to meet with the Fijian government and also to visit the relocation site to learn from them, because this is very new, the fact that communities are making this decision that relocation is their only adaptation option. So the human rights implications, so getting back to climate refugees, so the reason why that term is really inappropriate in this context is because the 1951 UN Convention relating to the status of refugees defines who a refugee is, and refugees are people who are fleeing persecution on account of one of these five protected grounds: race, religion, political opinion, membership in a social group, or nationality. Environmental change is not on there, clearly. But more importantly, what I tell people is, you know, refugees cannot rely on their country of origin to protect them. That is one of the fundamental pieces about being a refugee, is that your government is unwilling or unable to provide you with the protection that you need. And we should all expect that our country is going to want to protect us from these climate change impacts. And many of them do, like the Maldives has done an extraordinary effort to educate the international community of the human rights implications of climate change, to get the funding that they need to protect the human rights of their populations. So using refugees as the analogy is really inappropriate. And the thing that's significant about this issue of climate change and displacement, and these are a bunch of the different human rights doctrine or treaties that exist at the international level, like the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People and the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. None of them address this issue of climate change impacts, and particularly this piece that I think is really critical, this collective right to self-determination. And so a year ago, I had the honor of working with folks at this NGO called Displacement Solutions, and we came up with a human rights document that is now actually being talked about and used on some level to make sure that there is a specific human rights document to look at climate change and its impact on population displacement. So this piece about collective human rights. So, you know, if you're living with a community of people and when you're relocating, you want to make sure that you are still with that community of people, this would be a mechanism to make that possible. It's really important, obviously, for Indigenous peoples that they maintain their access to their customary subsistence rights. And so it's these sorts of things that we need to be thinking about when we're thinking about relocation of entire communities. And then nationally, I was really happy to see, so President Obama has had a task force on climate change, and the U.S. Congress last year, I guess in December of 2013, actually included this issue of a lack of an institutional framework for relocation in their recommendations for President Obama to actually take up. And we are really hopeful that in the last 2 years of his administration, he will implement this recommendation and create a task force to specifically look at the institutional challenges to relocation. So in starting, I talked about climigration, the word that I created, and my definition is this permanent displacement due to ongoing changes in a community's habitat that impacts public and private infrastructure as well as livelihoods, health, and well-being of people residing in a community. And it's really about community displacement. And then in thinking about the type of an institutional framework, I've thought of an adaptive governance that's a way for governance to be iterative, meaning that it can dynamically address the climate change impacts, because climate change is not static. It is going to continue to change as our temperatures increase. And so when I'm thinking of adaptive governance, I'm thinking of you always start with protection in place, because people are really connected to their homes, whether you're in Western Alaska, the Carteret Islands, or Rockaway Beach, New York. And so you always start with protection in place, and then you work with people living in those local communities to figure out when it's not possible to stay where you are because the technology cannot protect you where you are, to facilitate a relocation effort. And then the global consequences of this, which I hope you're thinking about, right? 10% of the world's population lives along the coast. There have recently been articles about Louisiana losing its boot. Louisiana right now is losing a football field of land every day because of subsidence and sea level rise. And again, it's, you know, the 90% chance that how much sea level is going to rise, we don't know, but it is going to rise 1 to 6.6 feet by the end of this century. So we're talking about potentially millions of people being displaced and no institutional framework yet in place. Thank you. So are there questions? And if you have a question, yes, go to the mic. Thank you.
Thank you for being here. About a month ago, senatorial candidate Sullivan said to the public radio station in Sitka that the jury is still out on climate change. So if he were to be, in fact, elected, and would you request an appointment with him, and what would you say to him?
I have met with the congressional delegation. I would happily meet with him, and again, I would show him a picture of Arctic sea ice. You know, when I talk with people who question whether or not climate change is happening, I often don't talk about the fact that we're causing it, because that is what sidetracks people, right? It really is what sidetracks people. And what's really important right now, and it's not to say that that's not important, because I started this talk by talking about how we have to reduce carbon emissions. So it's essential. But to get action on adaptation, right, we are so far into climate change, and we desperately need leadership on adaptation strategies. And so I would talk with him about Arctic sea ice and the fact that it's diminishing. And there's now all this emphasis on opening the shipping routes and drilling in the Arctic, and we need to be thinking about how we're going to adapt to these dramatic changes. So yes, that was a long answer to that, but yes.
What specifically would you urge the legislature and the governor to do in the near future to deal with these problems of climate-caused disruption?
So when Governor Palin was our governor, she created the subcabinet on climate change. And I had the honor of watching the immediate action work group deal with this issue, and they worked so hard. There was I believe he was the deputy commissioner at the time of the Department of Commerce, Community Development, and Economics. I can't remember the title of that. Anyway, the Department of Homeland Security, it was this intergovernmental immediate action work group that was addressing this. And what I would ask them is to reconstitute that immediate action work group, because they were far into trying to figure out this issue. And then there was also an adaptation working group and a mitigation working group and a research working group. So I would ask the legislature to reconstitute all of those working groups to address all of these critical issues for our state.
Are there any specific actions that you can identify now that these working groups should work on or take action on?
Well, so in regard to the relocation, I think that, so there are two pieces to the relocation. One is the critical needs of communities like Shishmaref, Kivalina, and Nutak, and figure out what needs to happen to get them to safety in a way that protects their human rights. So moving them without consulting with them or having them agree to where they would be relocated to would not work. It would be using the model of the Nutak Planning Group to work with these three communities to facilitate their relocation. And then for the longer term, to figure out, create a task force to think of what this institutional framework could look like to relocate other communities that may need to do that.
I grew up in Nenana and have lived on the Yukon and the Kuskokwim and the Koyukuk and the rivers, and have lived in many of the, looked like a couple of those villages that you showed as considering moving, and have been part of some teams. What I have, and I found a lot of cooperation from the Corps of Engineers, from HUD, from a lot of, and from state agencies, but it's coordination and the ability to coordinate those activities that I've that's been the most difficult part of that. Do you have any ideas on that?
Well, yes, and so that is the issue. And I think, you know, I am, having worked as an immigration attorney and dealt with our government a lot, it's really been impressive how the Army Corps of Engineers, the Division of Community and Regional Affairs, just to name a few, the Department of Homeland Security locally, have really tried to address this issue. But without this relocation institutional framework, so what you're talking about is the lead agency, somebody who's designated with the responsibility of coordinating the effort so that government agencies have a focal point. And that's what's needed, right, is the identification of a lead agency and figuring out what a relocation institutional framework would look like.
I grew up in northern Wisconsin near a lake that was about a mile in diameter. And it was always exciting in the spring to watch the ice come off the lake. And it would only take a breeze of a few miles an hour. It would melt around the edges first, and then a few mile an hour breeze would shift that mass of ice back and forth. And when it usually come to our side of the lake, and docks and shoreline fixtures were just smashed by this sheet of ice. And when I saw your map, I saw in my mind that lake that I grew up near. Is there such a thing that the Arctic ice mass would be free in the summertime, that entire sheet could kind of move as a unit and go on shore in places and actually act like rapid glacial plowing or such, where it would damage large sections of shoreline. Do you know what I'm saying?
I do know what you're saying, and I don't know the answer to that question. So what's happening with Arctic sea ice? Arctic sea ice used to be the natural barrier for coastal communities. So when, like, this super typhoon that's heading up the Bering Sea, there would be ice along the shore to protect the communities from the storm surges that are coming in. And so with this decrease in Arctic sea ice, that's no longer happening. And I don't know. I don't know if anybody knows about, you know, what will happen with Arctic sea ice as the temperatures continue to warm and the sea ice becomes more fragmented.
I seem to recall some interesting partnerships with U.S. military for some of the recent Alaska migration efforts. Are there other partnerships, creative partnerships that you see that should be taken advantage of?
That's a great question. And so it was the U.S. military was helping the community of Newtok. That was one of the creative partnerships. They have, I believe it's an innovative readiness training program where they work within the United States to gain the skills for what they may need outside of the United States. And so they were committed to working with Newtok, I believe, for 5 years and helped build one of the roads that's now at their relocation site. And, I don't really have any ideas. What I know is there needs to be this institutional framework so that you can create new partnerships within this bigger frame so people know what they're doing and where they're going to get the authorization from.
I have a suggestion. With all due respect, all kinds of ways in which money is going to be required, lots and lots of money, lots of resources to meet these needs. I personally would urge people to be quite wary of militarizing these solutions. And maybe that's too strong a term, but that's a good way to throw a lot of money away, frankly. Not that military people cannot be creative. Many are very creative, but I'm glad you emphasized the involvement of local people. That's got to be primary.
Yes, well, and I would say, you know, in Newtok and the Carteret Islands, the one of the things that has been most important to them is to learn job skills to build at their relocation sites. So both of them have been, for them, it's been a priority. And in regard to the funding piece, you know, nobody really knows how much it's going to cost because, you know, every community in Alaska gets access to capital funding for schools and health clinics. And the challenge is, without this relocation institutional framework, there's no mechanism to shift that funding that's normally available to communities at their current location to a relocation site, right? And so when the numbers that often get thrown around are based on a U.S. Army Corps of Engineers study that was done, I believe, in 2006, where the Army Corps of Engineers was thinking the federal government would pay for everything, which has not happened with Newtok, right? They've been using existing funding streams and getting some new money to fund the relocation effort that's taken place.
Thanks for a very interesting and disturbing talk. I was wondering if you saw any role for the University of Alaska in this process, and not just a role, but has the university expressed any interest in either facilitating this beyond just studying what's going on, but facilitating something or setting up some program to train those who could deal with these issues?
That's a great question. And so my primary advisor, Dr. Terry Chapin, is brilliant and at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And he started a community partnership for self-reliance and sustainability project, where it was, so four communities applied to participate, and what it was is they came forward to the university and said, these are the resources we need to adapt to climate change. And so, and that project is still ongoing. And so what this project is trying to do is reframe it. So as opposed to like me going to New Talk and saying, I'm interested in researching this issue, communities through this community partnership would come to the university and say, these are the resources we need in order to adapt to climate change.
May I have another turn?
Sure.
As you said, the retreating sea ice and the villages of Alaska along the coast are harbingers of what's going to happen. And you also said that there will be millions of people displaced, avoiding your term of environmental refugees. In that case, in that scenario, as that begins to unfold, the people, a few thousand people of the villages of Alaska will be lost in the shuffle to accommodate the millions of people coming out of Florida. So is there any value in what you showed us about the president's initiative to begin planning for this, to begin planning for this, to arouse the people of this country, not to say the rest of the world, to how we're going to accommodate these folks who have probably lost their equity in their houses and their businesses, may have some money in the bank, but need to move someplace else? The millions of people, and then maybe the folks of Alaska will be somehow embraced by that.
Well, I think the people of Alaska will be first embraced, you know, given that they are in the most critical situation. And when I've met with the White House, you know, there's no framework to address this issue anywhere in the world. Fiji is the only government that is actually trying to figure out how to relocate communities. And so there's tremendous benefit to the United States taking the lead in trying to figure this out. And the human rights implications, so the other piece to this that makes it complicated is that when governments have relocated populations, whether it's for geopolitical motives, so if you're thinking here in Alaska and the Aleuts who were forcibly relocated during World War II, or you look at India and China, where the Indian and Chinese governments are forcibly relocating people to build dams, those relocations have been disastrous for people. So when I present this research, you know, around the world, there are often people from the World Bank who have been involved with those projects who say those relocations have been so harmful to people and caused their further impoverishment. And so that's why I base this in human rights. And the only antonym to a government-mandated relocation is if people actually get to decide themselves. And maybe that won't be possible in every circumstance, but because there's so much education that needs to be done on this issue and because nothing exists, that's the place where I start. Let's figure out, because these communities in Alaska have really been at the forefront of showing what being proactive to climate change means by identifying relocation sites, voting on relocation sites. The community of New Talk hired a lobbyist who lobbied Congress because their relocation site is actually on Fish and Wildlife land. So they hired a lobbyist who lobbied Congress for 8 years before they got title to their land, right? And so it's figuring out how to create a relocation institutional framework that gives people the opportunity to make this choice, knowing that, you know, there are lots of reasons in the United States. So I mentioned all of the reasons why government-mandated relocations have been disastrous. But there's this other piece where we think that technology is going to protect us. We have been led to believe that our government will do whatever possible to keep us in our places, right? And so the if you look at Hurricane Sandy, it's all about rebuilding, right? It's like we're going to build back better. And it's not to say those things shouldn't happen. It's just to be thinking, how long are we going to be able to build back better, right, with the way that sea level is rising? I mean, when I looked at the plans. So what the government of New York did was they held out a competition to figure out who, you know, could come up with the best idea of how to protect them. And they had barrier islands. They were going to create barrier islands off the coast of New Jersey, but they wouldn't be so great with sea level rise, and they were thinking of, like, building seawalls in front of lower Manhattan, but depending on how much sea level rise, you can't really keep the Hudson River in. And so there aren't really great options, right? And we're seriously behind the curve. And, you know, and I use the Netherlands as an example because, right, the Netherlands, they, like, Amsterdam is under sea level, and they are spending, I believe, $200 billion a year to figure this out, and they're using a 200-year time frame. And even, and their premise is we need to make room for more water, right? So they're starting this community engagement going, okay, like, we've got to have this conversation about the fact that sea levels are rising and we're not going to be able to stay where we are. And so that's the conversation that needs to happen here in the United States. Thank you.
That was Robin Bronin discussing climate change and human rights in this Juneau World Affairs Council presentation, produced in collaboration with 360 North. It was recorded on November 5, 2014 at 360 in Juneau, with support from GCI, Alaska Electric Light and Power Company, Wastman & Associates Incorporated, Coeur Alaska Incorporated, Hecla Greens Creek Mining Company, Sea Alaska, and Alaska Power and Telephone.